Hey, it's Tim Slover from KUER. You like podcasts, right? I do. So this month, we're asking you to tell someone about a podcast you think they'll love. That could be your mom or a friend or, I don't know, someone who doesn't really get podcasts yet, anybody. You can pick whatever podcast you want. Maybe it's about music or politics, maybe cooking or Stranger Things fan theories or rodeo clowning or meditation. Just get a friend to listen. Remember to hit the share button and use the hashtag tripod. That's try with a Y followed by pod because of jokes. And thanks for getting the word out.
I'm very concerned if we don't pass this bill today that this will be an initiative.
If they don't listen to the will of the people will speak.
We can be reasonable, we can communicate, we can be respectful, we can be civil, we can find common ground.
And if our partners buckle under this political pressure, if the hard choices just become too hard, then we'll just keep moving forward.
Mr. Speaker, in conclusion, the $10 founding father without a father who got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter, by 14, they place him in charge of a trading charter.
Welcome to 45 Days, a KUER news podcast where we break down week by week the bills, lawmakers, and the events of the 2017 Utah legislative session. I'm Terry Gilday, KUER's news director, and I'm in studio with reporters Judy Face, Julia Ritchie, Lee Hale, Eric Newman, and Nicole Nixon. Hi.
Hello. Hey there.
Signy die. It's over. It's done. The 2017 Utah legislative session is history. It ended Thursday night. We're all still a little bit tired from all the coverage that we did. We had the entire news team up there at the Capitol last night, along with some of our marketing crew was doing some Facebook Live. So we're still a little sleep deprived, but we're going to do our best in this final podcast of 45 days to go over what happened over the session. So let's start with alcohol and guns. Lots of big takeaways from this session. Some incredibly large alcohol reform legislation passed. Did it make things simpler? I'm not sure. We also had some interesting bills on guns and concealed carry. So, Nicole, you've been covering alcohol from the beginning of the session. Tell us about HB 442. This passed a couple of days ago, and it's the giant alcohol bill. It's the giant reform bill that supposedly would get rid of the Zion curtain. What actually did it do, or will it do?
It did a lot of things. And if you remember back to the very beginning of the session, actually, I think in Governor Herbert's State of the State address, he mentioned that the goal on these alcohol reform bills was to overall improve public safety. And they say that with all these bills, they've done that. There was, of course, Representative Brad Wilson's large alcohol reform bill that deals with taking down the Zion curtains, giving restaurants more options there. That bill also creates education programs about underage drinking for 8th graders and 10th graders at the cost, of course, of a slight increase in the price of alcohol, that state markup to 88% now. There was also the bill to lower the legal blood alcohol limit from 0.08 to 0.05. National transportation officials say that this could save as many as 63 lives in Utah every year, taking out drunk drivers off the road. And supporters of this bill says that it sends a strong message that if you're going to drink in Utah, you shouldn't drive at all. Other people weren't happy with these bills. They say the blood alcohol limit just contributes further to the stereotype that maybe Utah is unfriendly to drinkers. House Speaker Greg Hughes didn't support the BAC bill because he said he was worried about unintended consequences that it might have. And with HB 442, the giant alcohol bill, some people, mostly Democrats, say that it doesn't go far enough, and they think that the state should get out of the alcohol business completely and let the private sector work it out. They were also unhappy with the alcohol markup to 88%. That rate is the highest in the nation now, by the way.
So highest markup on alcohol, lowest legal intoxication level.
Yes.
And that's if Governor Herbert signs those bills. Governor Herbert was in the Capitol on Thursday talking about this. What did he say about HB 155? This is the legal intoxication bill.
So Governor Herbert seems very happy with these bills overall that they've been passed. Here's what he said about all of these yesterday.
Again, I think overall this is a very net positive step forward when it comes to public health and safety of the people of Utah with our alcohol law revision.
So I think that we can expect him to sign most or all of these bills.
Will this hurt business? Does this stigmatize Utah in relation to other places in the country? Does this reinforce some of the negative stereotypes we have here?
There definitely is that argument, especially from Democrats, especially in the Senate. That came up a lot. People voted against the HB 442 because they say it, you know, it's not really doing much. There are these other options now for restaurants, but, you know, they just think that the state should privatize liquor, and that would be the best route for businesses.
And privatization has been on the table in past sessions, but it wasn't on the table this session.
Nope.
So we'll see if that pops up in further sessions down the road. Nicole, another really important bill that you've covered throughout the session, which finally passed on Thursday night, this is HB 198. This would establish a provisional concealed carry weapon permit for 18 to 20-year-olds. Now, the argument behind people voting for this bill and supporting this bill is that it has the potential to protect women in a situation of sexual assault or rape. That was a pretty powerful argument, but there were still some female lawmakers who voted against it as well.
Yeah, some people say that they were worried about the impact it might have on suicides and crime and violence on college campuses. They say that people this young, between the ages of 18 and 20, their brains are still developing, and they worry about increasing access to dangerous weapons for people that young.
And partly because there's high suicide rates in Utah.
Right, Utah has one of the highest, I think the highest youth suicide rate in the country.
So that argument is just we're making guns more accessible to this group.
I asked Governor Herbert if he would sign this particular piece, and he said he had to study it a little bit more, so it's not clear if he'll give it his signature. He did use the other argument that you hear a lot in these situations, which is that if you can be drafted in the military and fight for your country and use an AR-15 or whatever you use over there, then you should be able to do the same. And I think it kind of follows that this might lend him to sign the legislation. I'm not sure, though.
Yeah, there have been a lot of different arguments for and against this bill. It's been interesting to see those play out.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if Governor Herbert does sign it, because concealed carry bills, it's always difficult for him to bring his pen to the dotted line and sign those. So we'll keep our eyes on that as he moves into the stage where he begins signing legislation and making it law. Let's pivot over now to education. Lawmakers gave Governor Gary Herbert what he wanted, which was a 4% bump in the weighted pupil unit. They were talking about 3%. The governor wanted 4%. They passed that money, finally. Lee, you've been covering education throughout the session and education spending. What's the significance of a 4% bump in the weighted pupil unit? What are the long and short-term effects of that?
Well, there was a significant thing that happened yesterday where there was a letter that was read in both the House and the Senate thanking the legislature for this money, and it was from the Utah Education Association, the Utah Board of Education. All these organizations came together and said, kind of the tone was like, this is a little bit more than we expected, I think, right? Because originally on the budget, I think it was 3%, but Herbert wanted 4%, and then that's kind of where they knocked it up to 4%. It's a lot of money. It's more than I think that people are used to seeing, I think, in Utah, and that's why I think these organizations were very grateful. But there's a lot of people on the other side who say, you know, yes, this is an uptick and this is going in the right direction, but it's not enough. I think right now we need at least a 2.5% increase every year just to keep our heads above water. And so it's a little bit more than that. But I was talking to Senator Gene Davis, who's the minority leader in the Senate, and he was saying we're still treading water. You know, we're kind of patting ourselves on the back for something that we're basically just staying alive.
Well, Thursday night, the final night of the session, you did a story about a letter that was read in both chambers of educators thanking lawmakers for what they had done. And it felt, correct me if I'm wrong or let me know what you think, but it felt like lawmakers were sort of patting themselves on the back for the big job they did for education. Is that accurate?
Well, I think that people were genuinely thanking them. I think these organizations were thanking them that this was a positive step in the right direction. But, you know, Our Schools Now is an initiative that's out there that's been referenced a lot. They propose $750 million in new spending. Basically, the legislature is comfortable with a third of that. And so, yes, organizations are saying this is an improvement. We are increasing the spending. But, you know, is that enough going forward? Who knows?
And the other variable with education in the session was teacher salaries. And you and I have had a lot of discussions about teacher compensation in the state, how low it is. if the legislature was doing anything at all. There was a really kind of funky joint resolution that in the House, HJR 8, where lawmakers said if we just had control of public lands, we could raise teacher salaries, which was an interesting political move to marry, you know, the controversial idea of taking control of public lands and using that money to benefit teachers. What happened with teacher salaries in the session?
Well, not a lot. But what I've learned, and I think that maybe the rest of you have seen this with the bills you covered, I think the legislature likes to give themselves a little bit of wiggle room to like improve, make a small improvement so they can discuss a topic as if they're making a big improvement, if that makes sense. Like, for one thing, a bill that did pass increases salary for about 100 teachers, effective teachers at low income, high poverty schools in the state. So 100 teachers will get a $5,000 bonus. That's a small drop in the bucket. But that was like a debate where people got to stand up and say, we support our teachers, so they deserve more money. They don't get enough. But then you think, well, this is only affecting 100 teachers. There's other bills that were, I mean, the House Democrats were supporting a bill that would have helped with down payments on housing for teachers that didn't go anywhere. Really, there wasn't a lot of improvement in salaries, but there was these kind of a small gain and a lot of, I think that was a sense where they were kind of patting themselves on the back saying, we are rewarding these hardworking teachers, but it really doesn't affect too many.
It'll be interesting to see how that 4% bump in WPU works out over the next year, but education has always been and will always be a marquee issue in every Utah legislative session.
Lee, I wanted to ask you how the threat of the ballot initiative is played into education this year.
I think that legislators think they have a really good handle on what the regular Utah constituent wants, and I think that most of them don't think this ballot initiative has any chance, really, getting the signatures to get on the ballot and then eventually being voted in to law. But I'm mainly curious, and I think other people are really curious to see, like, would Utah vote in the way that the legislature does, or are Utahns willing to spend a little bit more taxes to basically get this uptick in spending? I don't think that people have talked about it as a threat as much. I think that's, you know, I think most people just kind of, they know it's there and they'll let it happen. But I think that they're pretty certain that they have the voice of Utahns, and they have their basically their needs in mind.
Let's move on to the environment and public lands in the session. And on the public land side, Judy, you've been covering this from the beginning. I think the biggest takeaway had to do with a couple of House resolutions that dealt with either shrinking or doing away with national monuments, and this really precipitated an enormous and very public feud between GOP lawmakers, including the governor, and at the Outdoor Industry Association, which at this point seems to have resulted in the exit of the Outdoor Retailer Show from Salt Lake City. Big news out of the session with this stuff.
Yeah, and it seems as though this has been something that's been building for a while. There were a lot of legislators who kind of commented that they thought that the outdoor retailers were sort of being like petulant children, demanding children and throwing a tantrum. And fine, I think I remember House Speaker Greg Hughes saying, well, you know, am I going to let a guy who makes coats tell me what to do in my policies? But, you know, I think it was really a symptom of a broader problem in all of our environmental issues here in the state. And that's it. I think everyone feels misunderstood, whatever side you're on. The House Speaker went on the floor to actually represent the Bears Ears resolution. And he talked about his experience of going down to southern Utah and why those people captured his heart and captured these arguments.
Why was it so emotional? I'll tell you why. There was a palpable sense that someone from thousands of miles away, by decree, was encumbering this community's land and suggesting, or even directly stating, that this community was incapable of the responsible stewardship of their county and of that land.
And it was interesting because at the time that he was making these remarks, there were a bunch of people outside of the House chamber protesting. They included Native Americans, Mormon environmental stewards, and some business people from southern Utah, including a builder named Mark Austin. And he was very frustrated because he'd been trying to meet with some of the legislative leaders to talk about why these resolutions really hadn't had no meaning, and they were actually working contrary to Southern Utah.
Nowhere are our opinions being represented, not by our city, county, or state representatives. Zero.
So, again, I think people felt really misunderstood throughout the session, and legislators passed a lot of aspirational measures, things, you know, what we would do if we controlled federal lands, and aren't we wonderful because we're not going to pursue a lawsuit to transfer public lands because we believe that the new Trump administration is on our side, that we don't really even need to have conversations because it's all going to come together.
Is the Trump administration really on the side of Utah? I mean, that's their argument. That's the capital, the political capital they bring to the table. But does it really exist? I mean, could the Trump administration really side with Utah on this, or are they preoccupied with 18 other things? Is this on their plate?
You know, I think that's a great question. Everyone said that the new Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, would come to Utah right away after he was confirmed and took office. And it turns out, I was asking around yesterday, and it turns out that he's probably not going to get to Utah for a month, two.
By horseback, right?
Appaloosa.
He's starting the trip from Pennsylvania Avenue right now on horseback.
Exactly. No, and everyone said that this was going to be his first visit. The Native Americans have invited him here. The business people have invited him here. Pretty much everybody in Utah has invited him to come look at Bears Ears. And he's not made arrangements yet to make that trip. So, again, everyone wants to be understood and feels like they're just trying to get a voice in the discussion. That's a kind of interesting segue to the broader question of, for instance, air quality funding. The governor had requested $1.3 million in his budget to update monitors and some other money for other research and monitoring programs that are out there. And they didn't find out until 4 o'clock the day before the end of the session that money was actually going to be available. It was not in the budget, and they were actually going to have to cut monitoring and cut people in the air quality department up until that time.
Did they underestimate one-time money, or is this one-time money, or is this continuous funding? Do we know?
Most of it is one-time money, but some of it is ongoing money. And so it wasn't like it was built into the budget for the long term, but it definitely does have a huge impact on the research. In the research area, the Department of Environmental Quality needs these air monitors to get the data that is required to put a plan together to bring Utah into compliance with the federal air quality laws. And in fact, the plan that they have out there now, one of the big criticisms is, you know, you don't have data. You have whole gaps in your data profile, so we don't know whether you are going to qualify or not to get off that nasty list.
And didn't they cut some of their budget personnel in the Department of Environmental Quality this year?
Well, they did, but then they put it back.
Oh, they
I mean,
put
that
it back.
That
okay.
was part of the funding in the end. Mm-hmm. They did not have those losses.
Yeah, but you still saw some money going toward like a sage grouse lawsuit and some other. That is money that could have gone toward the air quality monitoring that Governor Herbert had asked for at the beginning of the session, and it just didn't.
Yeah.
Speaking of environmental priorities, one of Governor Herbert's pet projects, there was an interesting bill that came out about that to help bring Tier 3 gasoline to refineries here and get it into Utah cars. You've been covering this for a long period of time. Talk to us about this bill that I believe is incentives for refineries here, correct?
It is, but it actually started out as a huge incentive for manufacturers, $87 million over 2 or 3 years. To give them a little bit more of a sales tax exemption over the next couple of years. And then it got whittled down to about $3 million over 2 years. The thing is that at least two of the Utah refineries, if I remember correctly, already produce Tier 3 gas. That's two out of the five refineries. And then a third refinery, Tesoro, has already promised that it was going to make these changes regardless of the funding situation. And so, to me, it's a question of who's going to really be using these incentives and whether they were really necessary. And so this is an issue of, you know, did we really understand what was on the line? And I think Representative Wilson, who presented the bill in the House, said this is going to be the big air quality vote of his whole career. his whole political career, which I thought was very interesting because Tier 3 is already on its way.
And Tier 3 gasoline, just so our listeners know, is much cleaner. It has about 80% less sulfur. And as you and I have talked, Judy, you sort of compare it to taking sometimes 4 out of 5 cars off the road. This could really put a dent in the particulate matter smog problem we have.
Mm-hmm. The Tier 3 program applies to both cars and to fuel. So you get benefits whether you have Tier 3 fuel or a car that meets those clean car standards. So together, they're supposed to amount to that 4 out of 5 cars off the road. Yeah, and that's half of our pollution problem in northern Utah. So it's pretty significant.
Let's move on to a couple of other bills, Eric, that you've been covering on the healthcare side. First of all, one that passed in the final night of the session, HB 141. This deals with abortion and a doctor's responsibility to inform women who are receiving an abortion through certain kinds of medication about the risks and about being able to stop that abortion. Tell us about HB 141 and what you learned covering it on the final night of the session.
Right. So HB 141, it's a bill that was brought by Kevin Stratton and Kurt Bramble in the House and Senate. And basically, it applies to women who are seeking to get a medication-induced abortion, which is when you take this cocktail of two different drugs. The bill is saying that after you take the first round of drugs, there's evidence enough that you can still stop that process and still potentially have a healthy child. I think the language in the bill is, in the current version, is that a woman may still have a viable pregnancy. And so that kind of, that language is kind of the heart of why these amendments to the existing abortion laws are interesting. The criticism behind it is that the science is very limited in terms of making that claim. It's been kind of interesting to watch this bill because as it's evolved, it started out with a little bit different language that more closely cited mostly this doctor in California that has talked about how it's possible to interrupt the process of having a medication-induced abortion, and it's been referred to as a abortion reversal procedure. And that claim appears to be pretty widely disputed by a lot of different, like in academic journals and by some OBGYNs. And so over the course of the session, that language has kind of been tweaked to be a little bit softer. But there's still sort of this dispute about how substantiated those claims are and those facts are. And it was interesting last night because we heard during the Senate process, Senator Lyle Hilliard was asking the Senate sponsor Kurt Bramble about this issue. And basically was asking him if this claim is what doctors would generally agree upon. And this is Senator Bramble's response.
You know, we're all entitled to our own facts. Doctors are entitled to their own facts. And the facts are that not every pregnancy is terminated upon taking this medication.
So it's kind of an interesting example because while what he's saying is true itself, it's factually accurate, it's kind of taking a look at the data that is more limited than the typical scientific
hashtag
evidence
alternative facts.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
So I think that's the short.
Kind
the
of an interesting, timely thing to be looking at.
It's hard not to feel like lawmakers again are making decisions about medical processes, and they're not doctors, and they're making decisions about women's health, and they're not doctors. It's hard for me to parse anything else out from what's happening, especially hearing about the conversation that you have with Senator Bramble.
How many cases did you say this really applied it to? What evidence?
Well, so the original bill, which cited this sort of abortion reversal procedure, was based on the cases of 6 women, I believe 4 of whom were shown to have healthy births after this procedure, after sort of like halting this medication-induced abortion happened, which six cases, in my understanding, does not constitute a scientific study. So that's kind of the big criticism of this. Again, as this bill has evolved, that language has kind of been softened to say, like, it's possible that a woman may still have a viable pregnancy.
But now under this bill, if the governor signs it, and he hasn't yet, doctors would be required to inform women of this possibility.
That's right.
That's what we're talking about. That's right. The binding legislation here.
Right.
Is that doctors have, if prescribing this medication or giving this medication to a woman who's about to have a medication-induced abortion, they have to tell them about this.
Correct. Right? It's one of many things that doctors have to tell women who are seeking an abortion, and it would also have to be included in the published and printed materials at the Department of Health.
I'm curious how much artistic liberty a doctor would have in explaining it to a patient, right? Because you could say, there's this thing, and then you could have 10 disclaimers. You know, I wonder, like, if there's anything binding in that way.
Having read, you know, I can't really answer that question, but having read the bill in full, there's a lot of specific things that have to be explained to women who are interested in getting an abortion. So I would assume that they don't have a lot of wiggle room in how they explain this.
Eric, another thing that you covered this session were several pieces of legislation dealing with opioid abuse and opioid addiction. Talk to me about what happened in the session when it came to managing opioids.
Yeah, so there was a variety of bills. One that was really interesting was HB 50, opioid prescribing regulations, which Representative Raymond Ward, who's a family medicine doctor in Bountiful, brought forward. It's interesting because my understanding is that in past sessions, there's been a lot of legislation towards opioids, but it's kind of at the end of the process after somebody's already addicted, you know, like we're going to make it possible for naloxone to be available to help people if they've overdosed. Representative Ward has taken this very upstream approach where he's trying to address how opioids are prescribed to people in the first place to try to stop addiction from happening. And basically, this law that he has put forward that passed last night, I believe, would require doctors who are prescribing short-term narcotic prescriptions to only prescribe them for 7 days at a time. And that's important because a lot of these drugs, they'll wind up getting prescribed for several weeks, and that's the same amount of time that it may take somebody to become addicted and become dependent on them. So he's putting this rule in place that says doctors have to, they can prescribe something for 7 days if it's an acute injury, not a chronic long-term one. And then if the person needs more drugs, they have to go back to the doctor and they have to get essentially their prescription refilled again. So Representative Ward had an interesting sort of description as someone who's a doctor talking about this issue.
We badly, strongly need to get away from the habit of giving people 3 and 4 weeks worth of pills at a time for a short-term prescription and winding up that the person themselves is addicted by the time they're through that, or that they leave those pills in their medicine cabinet and then their children or family or friends use them and become addicted.
And so, yeah, so his concern is really, we're giving all these drugs to people that are in the span of time that they can become addicted themselves, or maybe they have a reaction where they're like, my body's not agreeing with these drugs, so I'm only going to take them for 2 days, and then there's going to be this pile of leftover drugs in somebody's medicine cabinet that then their kids or somebody else can wind up taking. So it was, in a lot of ways, it was not a controversial bill. There was a lot of talk about it, but I think in every committee and in the House and the Senate, it passed pretty unanimously, but could take a pretty big impact, or could have a pretty big impact on this problem, which I think Utah is still number 4 in the country in terms of opioid addiction.
We're way up there, that's for sure. Let's talk about affordable housing and homelessness and what happened in the legislature with that. Julia, you covered HB 441. This is the bill that will help fund homelessness and homeless shelter efforts. How much money will this funnel into the proposed homeless shelter sites, the 3 that we have on the board right now, 2 in Salt Lake City and 1 in Salt Lake County?
Right. So last year, the state legislature committed something like more than $20 million to this effort. So this year, all they did was they came back and they said, okay, we're going to give you the second half of that. So they ended up apportioning something like $9.8 million to help build those 2 new homeless resource centers in Salt Lake and then a third one somewhere in Salt Lake County. They also put a firm closing date on the road
The
Road Home Shelter. Sorry, I'm new, so I'm still learning the names of these things. But it goes back to, at the beginning of the session, Governor Herbert, Speaker Greg Hughes, President of the Senate, Wayne Niederhauser, all said homelessness is something that we care about and we're going to put a lot of effort into. Yet we really didn't see this bill until maybe like the last few days of the session. So that kind of speaks to some of the backroom deals and some of the closed door meetings they had to figure out the details of this. And I think halfway through the session is when we had that sort of surprise announcement between Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City and the state that said, hey, we're going to scrap Salt Lake City's plans for these four homeless shelters. And they kind of redid the whole thing. So this is the grand bargain that they ended up with. Some homeless advocates say, you know, we wanted more, but this is a start. That's like the number one thing I think I heard last night at the session was, well, this bill is a start. And so they're saying, you know, we'll come back next year. We'll keep working for this. Representative Becky Edwards also had a really interesting bill that she fought for all session, and she actually got it through. That was HB 36, and that would put more money toward affordable housing. So like right now, there was a recent study done by the National Low Income Housing Coalition, and they said Salt Lake, actually the whole state of Utah, lacks something like 47,000 units of affordable housing. And that's for people in that 30% of average median income. So that's if you make $10 an hour or between $25,000 and $30,000 a year. So those people are the least served right now. So what her bill would do, pump more tax credits, about $7 million over 10 years, to encourage developers to develop and actually build those units that would actually go for lower than market rate right now. She also got a new incentive fund, which is a little bit better deal than tax credits, and because it's the developers who use that money will actually pay it back. So sometimes there's a debate about, you know, tax credits. Are we giving too many incentives to state to people that should just be doing this on their own goodwill? And the truth of the matter is sometimes you have to put those little carrots out there to get people to do the right thing.
Julia, you were also covering some election law reform bills. We had the resurgence of a lawsuit this year against SB 54. And a little background, this was a bill that passed a few years ago that preserved the caucus convention system but allowed another path for candidates to get to the ballot that wasn't a direct primary via signatures. And at first, the Utah GOP signed off on this and they said, that's okay, we'll support this. They quickly changed their mind and began suing the state of Utah over it. They dropped the lawsuit briefly. They decided to reinstate that lawsuit. This has given Senator Kurt Bramble, Republican Senator Kurt Bramble, kind of a headache because he's the architect behind SB 54. There was a bill that was trying to reconcile some of these differences, but it didn't make it through quite on the final night of the session.
Right. So that was called SB 114, and it was trying to deal with some like outstanding issues from SB 54, in particular plurality. So when a candidate is running against other people in a primary and none of them get more than 50% of the vote, then how would the rules for that runoff election be determined? Well, they ended up gutting all that language, and the House was kind of like going over it last night. Who called it a roller coaster, Nicole?
Representative McKay called it a long roller coaster that it looks like he'll never get off of.
Yeah. Just a really like nauseating roller coaster, because halfway through the session again, the Utah GOP said, you know, we're going to resume this lawsuit because we can do so without incurring any more cost. And then that caused some more closed door dealing where the bill that Senator Bramble was working on got gutted. So even though the House ended up passing it at like the 11th hour last night, it did.
The 11th hour.
Yeah, it just died in the Senate.
It had to go back to, it was a sixth substitute, so it had to go back to the Senate after the House passed it, and it got stuck there.
Anything more than a fourth substitute, you're getting in real dicey ground. So
yeah.
I will say there were something like 60 bills this session dealing with elections. Of course, not very many of them actually ended up going through. But I think that speaks to the fact that there were a lot of issues in the last election. So we saw a lot of tiny tweaks and amendments here and there to try and improve voting. As a lot of states are putting in voter ID laws, Utah is actually trying to make it a little bit better through just sort of making it more accessible through the mail-in balloting, making it so that if you messed up your mail-in ballot, because there's so many rules to like where you should sign it, that you could have a chance to fix that. I think that bill made it through.
And that they notify you.
Exactly, that they notify you. So I think a lot of issues that we saw in the November election, we saw bills pertaining to that this time around.
Fantastic. Let's move to some final thoughts in the session. And I want to hone in on our three reporters in the room who have only been working for KUER for a few months. They're relatively new to Utah. I want to hone in on Eric and Lee and Julia for a second and get kind of your thoughts about what it was like to cover your first legislative session. Eric, what was it like for you? What did you learn about sort of Utah culture and Utah politics?
It was really an interesting introduction. I think
As he says, packing his bags and getting in his car and driving back to California. No, sorry, go ahead.
I think the one thing that I found fascinating, in addition to just learning about all the different elements of the legislature, was sort of how the use of regulation happens and when it happens and when it doesn't happen, because there was countless times when I saw people promoting a bill, congratulating each other based on cutting a regulation, about removing regulations. But yet there's also a lot of regulations that went into place that all seemed really to be based on aligning with the legislators' values. So there was regulation on marijuana before marijuana is even allowed to be used here. So like this pre-regulation, the regulation of alcohol to 0.05%, regulations related to abortion, regulations related to pornography. So it just seemed like there's a lot of talk about deregulation and the importance of that, but there's also a lot of regulation that happens.
Yeah, well, I think we should mention they passed a record number of bills this session, which was 535. So yes, for all this like deregulatory sort of zeal, they're also passing an inordinate amount of legislation this session, not all of which will be signed, but I thought that was funny too you noticed that.
Yeah.
Julia, anything else stand out for you with your first session?
I think it's a great time to be in Utah because anyone who has been there a while, I talked to them, we've seen an unprecedented level of activism. So we started the session with those 10,000 women kind of like marching up the hill, and we ended with them as well on International Women's Day. So we saw a lot more people getting involved in the process, a lot more people at committee hearings. In between there, I got to go to Representative Jason Chaffetz's town hall. So it's kind of interesting to see sort of like how all of this post-election angst is trickling down to the state level and the local level and causing people to actually care more about politics that will affect them more directly than anything Donald Trump will do. So I think that's been the most interesting thing, in addition to the fact that there are two Utahs, right? We live in our bubble, our Salt Lake bubble, but there are all these great rural legislators that come in with these bills. Mm-hmm. Like last night was Representative Chu was talking about his livestock harassment bill. So this bill passed in the 11th hour, and oh my God, it was like
so many good livestock
blue collar comedy tour. So basically that bill would make it so that you can't harass cows with drones. I mean, like what an amazing bill, right, to just see.
Finally, someone is thinking about the cows.
Exactly. Finally. But just like that merging of like Old West plus New West drones, like who would have ever thought that like people would be antagonizing these poor livestock with like, I don't know. I just love though that you see the people that come from these like far-flung parts of the state come to the legislative session for 45 days and they hammer out these issues together with people who live.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, and I just love seeing the process.
Lee, what did you get from your first session?
There's two big lessons. One was that there's some topics that just have such deep-rooted emotional ties that people have made up their mind before any legislation is ever drawn up. I covered a sex ed bill, and going to the committee hearing, it didn't matter what was written in that bill. People that were going to make a comment were going to make their comment no matter what. You know, it felt like this is something that's been talked about a lot, and people have their very distinct, whether it's religious or political or otherwise, views that are kind of immovable. And that was a bill where there was really good discussion, I thought, amongst the lawmakers themselves. But in the end, it didn't really make any difference in the way that they voted. So I guess it wasn't necessarily a huge revelation for me. It was just interesting to see it in action. How many people will show up to these committee meetings? How many people will voice their feelings, especially when it's a charged issue? And also, I mean, it's crazy what we expect of these lawmakers sometimes. You'll go to these committee meetings, and they have to go from almost no knowledge of a topic to voting on it, to determining if it's going to live within.
It's like being a journalist.
You hear that a lot, too. They'll get up and say, well, Senator so-and-so asked me to sponsor this bill, and I didn't know anything about it. But now I'm all for it, and it's interesting to hear.
Oh yeah,
how many times
there
that
was
happens.
A lesson on doxing last
yes.
night at the 11th hour.
Well, because you have to educate yourself in the committee, and then you have to go and educate all of your fellow legislators in however much time you have to come to this consensus. Obviously, there's discussions that happen outside of the floor time. But some of these are really delicate, detailed issues. I was looking at something that involves special ed law and the funding that goes for students with autism and their 504 plans and their IEPs. And I should know these things. I used to be a special ed teacher, but I was really confused. And I looked, at the committee, and I thought, this is...
Wasn't that the takeaway from that, was that really kind of everyone was in the dark about what the laws were?
Yes, a lot of people were in the dark. I mean, people were wondering, is what we're doing as a state illegal right now? Asking these people, from the State Board of Education, we don't know. And, it's just, there's just so many details that you have to take into account. And honestly, I was pretty impressed with the amount of discussion that went into it. There's some committee meetings I wanted to get out of because they were going on and on and on. But I think it was a testament to the fact that people will sit and they will listen and people get their chance at the mic. And so in that sense, it was pretty encouraging.
It's an interesting process.
Eric Newman, Nicole Nixon, Lee Hale, Julia Ritchie, and Judy Fais. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's a wrap for 45 Days. Thanks for joining us for our podcast. I'm sure we'll be around doing this next year. 45 Days is a production of KUER News. JT Nebaker composed our music. Tim Sliver and I produced the episode. I'm Terry Gilday.